Thanks for tuning in for the May 4th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's featured interview with Dr. Robert Stern focuses on the NINDS consensus diagnostic criteria for traumatic encephalopathy syndrome. For What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Dr. Adam de Havenon on the 5-year trends in payments for neurology prescribed drugs for Medicare Part D beneficiaries.
Hi, this is Alex Menzi. I'm with the Permanente Medical Group in Sacramento, California. Today, I'm interviewing Robert Stern from Boston University School of Medicine. We're going to discuss a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke Consensus Diagnostic Criteria for Traumatic Encephalopathy Syndrome. Good morning, Bob. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So you worked on a new set of diagnostic criteria for traumatic encephalopathy syndrome, and this relates with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Could you please tell us about the distinction between the two?
Sure. As a starting point, let's talk about CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a unique neurodegenerative tauopathy that can occur in people with a history of substantial repetitive head impacts, such as contact and collision sport athletes, combat military service members, and others. And this is a neuropathologically defined disease at this point. And TES, or traumatic encephalopathy syndrome, is referring to the clinical manifestation of this underlying neurodegenerative disease.
Okay, so to develop these diagnostic criteria, you worked with many different experts in the neurosciences. If you could, in one or two sentences, tell us what the goal of this undertaking was when you started.
Well, the goal was to develop evidence-informed, expert consensus diagnostic criteria for the clinical manifestations of this neurodegenerative disease, CTE. And the ultimate goal was to facilitate research and help close important knowledge gaps, including gaps in our understanding of the epidemiology of CTE, the risk factors for CTE, the course of the clinical manifestations, and also, importantly, to allow us to conduct clinical trials for potential treatment and prevention studies.
Okay, so, well, tell us how it went. What was the result of this effort with all these experts?
Well, this was part of an ongoing NINDS-funded multi-center study called the Diagnose CTE Research Project. The results now include detailed criteria for a diagnosis of TES, as well as criteria for what we refer to as provisional levels of certainty for underlying CTE brain pathology.
So why was this necessary? What was not happening in traumatic encephalopathy syndrome or CTE research that led to the need for clarification on these criteria?
Despite what people may think by hearing about CTE so often on the news, there remain many knowledge gaps in our understanding of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, due in part to the fact that right now a diagnosis of CTE can only be made through postmortem neuropathological examination. So there had been proposed criteria for the clinical diagnosis of CTE, but they all had significant limitations, including one that my group developed back in 2014 when we published proposed research diagnostic criteria for what we then termed traumatic encephalopathy syndrome, or TES. But that was just based on comprehensive literature review of the symptoms and clinical course of autopsy-confirmed CTE cases at the time. And there weren't that many at the time, and we now know so much more about CTE. So those criteria, those 2014 criteria, have now been used in a bunch of studies with results underscoring all the limitations of those previous criteria. In fact, our group recently published a study, Jesse Mez was the first author, examining the validity of those 2014 criteria in predicting CTE pathology in over 300 brain donors with a history of repetitive head impact exposure that were all recruited since the publication of the 2014 criteria. And those results had some good news and bad news. The good news was that there was pretty good inter-rater reliability, and there was really high sensitivity for those previous diagnostic criteria. The bad news was that there was very low specificity for CT pathology. And so there was moderate or to strong evidence to being able to rule out, but very limited evidence to rule in CT pathology. And when individual TES criteria components were assessed using those old criteria, cognitive symptoms, but not the mood and behavioral symptoms or motor difficulties, were significantly associated with CT pathology. So, you know, that showed that what existed before wasn't that great, and we needed to really start moving forward with better ways of diagnosing CT during life.
So, Bob, you've been really helping to guide the development of this for, it sounds like, almost a decade at least. So could you run through the diagnostic criteria that you developed, kind of the different things that you look for in the living patient to see if you can diagnose traumatic encephalopathy syndrome?
Sure. So to be diagnosed with traumatic encephalopathy syndrome with these new criteria, the individual must have a lot of exposure to repetitive head impacts. They have to have then specific symptoms and course of those symptoms, and another disorder other than CTE cannot fully account for those symptoms. More specifically, the person must have substantial exposure to those repetitive head impacts from contact sports, military service, or other causes. So for example, there would need to be a minimum of 5 years playing organized American football, with two or more of those years played at the high school level or beyond. So number two, there'd need to be a progressive course of cognitive impairment, specifically episodic memory and or executive functioning, or what we refer to as neurobehavioral dysregulation, including explosiveness, impulsivity, rage, violent outbursts, and emotional lability. And you could have both, the cognitive impairment or the neurobehavioral dysregulation. And then there'd also have to be a good sense that other neurologic, psychiatric, or medical conditions cannot be fully responsible for those clinical problems. Although you could have comorbid neurologic or psychiatric conditions diagnosed together with TES.
The neurobehavioral dysregulation aspect of this seems very important to these diagnostic guidelines. So before, in 2014, there was a criteria for non-specific mood and behavior features. So what was so essential about the dysregulation, the explosiveness, impulsivity, rage, and these diagnostic criteria? What did you find in amongst the experts in using that as a core criteria?
Yeah, it's a really important issue, and it's a little complex. Number one, in the previous criteria, it was really, really easy to get a diagnosis of traumatic encephalopathy syndrome because anyone who had a presentation or history of depression or anxiety or things that had a very high base rate, idiopathic conditions. And so one of the issues was to try to make this more specific to what is seen in individuals with a history of the repetitive head impact exposure, but also to use the data from validity studies using the criteria to predict neuropathological CTE. Taking all of that into account, these 20 clinician scientists, experts, discussed and went back and forth and back and forth, and finally came up with this view that there was this more specific syndrome that seemed to be present. And it included this dysregulation of emotion and behavior, such as explosiveness and impulse control problems, rage, violence, and emotional ability. And taken together, we refer to that now as neurobehavioral dysregulation.
As clinical neurologists, a lot of us are wondering if we can really utilize these guidelines in the care of our patient population. You mentioned before that people were just kind of getting diagnoses of CTE while they were living and running around and living their lives. Do you have any recommendations for the general neurologists in using these guidelines, or do you recommend any caution in diagnosing of traumatic encephalopathy syndrome?
Yeah, right now, unfortunately, I don't think we're really yet at the point of being able to diagnose CTE during life. We're getting much closer. These new criteria help, but more research is needed. The primary goal of these new NINDS consensus diagnostic criteria for TES was to facilitate further CTE research so we will be able to provide accurate diagnoses during life. We actually stress in the paper that these criteria are not meant to be used by healthcare providers at this point to make a clinical diagnosis of CTE. We're going to need to revise these criteria and update them as more information becomes available. In particular, work on biomarkers for the diagnosis and detection of underlying CTE pathology. But for now, it's important for the general neurologist to understand that a diagnosis of TES, clinical syndrome, is not intended as a diagnosis of CTE, which is a neuropathological diagnosis. But yeah, there are many people out there who want to know if they have CTE. And despite the previous lack of expert consensus or validated diagnostic criteria for the clinical diagnosis of CTE, a recent study from some colleagues at Harvard found that in a survey of almost 4,000 former NFL players, 108 of them reported having been given a diagnosis of CTE by a clinician. And the authors of that paper cautioned that receiving a diagnosis of CTE during life could actually produce a nocebo effect, leading to potential additional mental health difficulties. And most importantly, a reduction in the diagnostic evaluation and intervention for treatable conditions. And so that's really the big issue, that people need to be evaluated for and treated for the things that can be addressed, whether or not they're caused by underlying CTE pathology. And as we get closer with biomarkers validated and available, I think we're going to get to the point of being able to say, okay, this person has probable CTE, akin to what we do currently with Alzheimer's disease.
Well, thank you for that, Bob. It sounds like there's a lot of people being told that they might have CTE and that there's a strong recommendation of restraint due to not the least problem of creating this nocebo effect or making the patient actually worse. So we really need to restrain ourselves and handing out these diagnoses.
Exactly.
So thank you so much for your time today, Bob, and for sharing your expertise with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Alex, for having me.
I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Stern about his paper titled National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke Consensus Diagnostic Criteria for Traumatic Encephalopathy Syndrome. Thank you.
Hey, this is Jason Kral with the Neurology Podcast. For our featured article interview this week, we have Adam Dehavanon joining us. Adam is a stroke neurologist at the University of Utah, and we're discussing the article he wrote with colleagues published in this week's issue of the journal Neurology titled, 5-Year Trends in Payments for Neurologist-Prescribed Drugs in Medicare Part D. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Jason. Thanks for having me.
So I have to say, I think this paper couldn't be any more timely. You know, prior to COVID, our healthcare conversations here in the U.S. were really dominated about the cost of prescription drugs. It's something that Americans feel very strongly about, regardless of political party. And I think it's because our patients are increasingly at risk for financial toxicity from the drugs that we prescribe. And so, you know, a larger and larger portion of their income is being spent on copays, on insurance premiums, and there's certainly an opportunity cost that comes with that. We've done several podcasts on the prescription drug pricing problem, including a couple of interviews with your co-author on this paper, Brian Callaghan from the University of Michigan. Most recent of those was back on March 30th, 2020, where we discussed the effect of generic drugs in the multiple sclerosis market. So I encourage our audience to check those out if you haven't already. So today, Adam, we're talking about your paper on the cost of neurologist-prescribed drugs here in the U.S. And before we get into more detail, what did you find is happening to the cost of the drugs we prescribe?
So what we found looking from 2013 to 17 and focusing exclusively on drugs that were in the data set for that entire period of time. So if a drug entered as a brand name drug, it ended in the data set as a brand name drug. And what we saw was that generic medications remained remarkably consistent or stable in their cost, whereas brand name drugs increased in cost about 50%. And this is, you know, equivalent to buying an iPhone 2 in 2013 for $500. And then buying from Apple the exact same iPhone in 2017 for $750. Certainly in any other competitive market, that wouldn't be an option.
Yeah, so my understanding, and once again, not to get in too much detail, but is that this data that you were pulling from was Medicare Part D data, right? So outpatient prescription drug spending for individuals in the U.S. on Medicare over that five-year period. Is that right? Any other details from kind of the background of this that we need to know?
So it is Part D data, which is, of course, public, and about slightly over 70% of Medicare beneficiaries are captured in Part D data. It, of course, is a snapshot of neurologists prescribed medication, but a very large one, given that Medicare is, of course, the predominant insurer for older Americans. We were looking at an aggregated form of cost, which is how Medicare reports it, which is really all of the cost that is associated with a drug claim. So that could include any fees that were on top of the cost of the drug, the government subsidies that may apply, and then any other third-party payers, such as a private insurance plan.
Great. And so again, it sounds like the take-home here is really that while generic spending pretty much was flat, the cost of brand names continued to increase. Is that right?
That is, yeah. And what we saw was consistent increases in the cost of brand name medications. Because of the much higher cost of medications we use for multiple sclerosis, they actually represented a huge share of this roughly $27 billion of spending on drugs that we looked at, despite only being 4% of all claims for neurologists prescribed medications. They actually represented 50% of the cost here. So really an exorbitantly high cost for those medications.
Yeah, it's really incredible the outsized effect that MS drug spending has relative to its market share amongst all the other drugs that we prescribe. Any other noteworthy trends that you all found when you were looking at this data set that we should know about?
One other interesting trend that we saw in this data set was beginning in 2013, neurologists were prescribing 82% generic medications, which is considerably higher than some other specialties. But over time, going to 2017, that increased, and the proportion of generic prescriptions in 2017 was 88%. And this is accounted for by less neurologists prescribing a brand name with a generic equivalent. And to me, that speaks to neurologists understanding and really applying some of the data and information that has come from sources like the Academy of Neurology, pointing out the impact of these high-cost brand-name drugs. And I do think it represents neurologists looking for alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as you mentioned, this idea of financial toxicity is one that neurologists are increasingly aware of. And I think that's reflected in that statistic. You know, Adam, on the podcast, we've talked about ICER quite a bit over the last 2 years or so and the work that they do in value-based pricing. So that's the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review. They're based here in Boston. We've previously had Steve Pearson, the president of ICER, on here to talk about the work they're doing. So, you know, there's one organization that's putting the information out there for patients and providers to better understand the benefit that drugs provide relative to their costs. But, you know, thinking about us as neurologists and seeing patients every day, is there anything that we can be doing to help our patients with these rising drug costs?
Great question, Jason, because it's one I know we both struggle with in our practices. And I, after really looking at this data, have tried to switch over to generic medications whenever possible. And I think as well, you know, understanding if there is a branded form of a medication that you believe as a physician has additional benefit, it is important to talk to patients about why you chose that and what the benefit is, because they are often left with, you know, copays of hundreds or even, you know, $1,000 or more a month. And there are patients who I explain this to, and they say, well, you know, just doesn't make sense financially to me. I understand the benefit, but I want to go with the less expensive drug. And patients who feel the opposite, you know, I'm willing to dig deep and pay this exorbitant copay to get the best treatment in your opinion. But those are things that happen at the individual level. Have a lot of respect for ICER and as well in the Academy, the Neurology on the Hill, which are two very different programs, but looking at sort of similar things that can affect change on a larger scale. The first, ICER being data-driven approaches that take into account economic reality. And the second, Neurology on the Hill, being advocating at the level of government for really control of the cost of these medications. And there has been a lot of talk in recent years about doing that at a government, really a federal level. But thus far, we've not seen much in the way of concrete action to try to limit these increases in drug cost.
Terrific. Well, to our audience, I encourage you to check out this paper. Again, it was written by Adam Dehavanon and his colleagues. The title of the paper is 5-Year Trends in Payments for Neurologists Prescribed Drugs in Medicare Part D. It was published this week in the Journal of Neurology. Adam, thank you for your work on this, for joining us today, and for spending some of your time with us on the Neurology Podcast.
Thank you, Jason. Been a pleasure.
This is Jose Merino. Remember to check out this week's journal, which features an article that investigates whether glutamate and GABA are involved in the formation of epilepsy networks, and a study examining whether age-related clinical heterogeneity is modified by APOE genotype in patients with Alzheimer's disease. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.